This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Of all the planets in the galaxy, they chose ours.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematica Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Yes, this is Sam. My voice is just slightly different because I'm sick. Definitely not Adam. This week, we're going to be covering 1986's Critters, a surprisingly delightful movie that is totally not Gremlins. No, not Gremlins. Today, we're going to go over rolling as a form of locomotion. It's not just Sonic these days. Eating more food than you need to, using venom on your prey, and hunting as a pack. And then Libby's going to diving deep into the different types of heroes.
Cue, I need a hero. I'm holding out for a hero.
You can find time codes at the bottom of the episode description if you want to jump ahead into those topics. But I am Adam Hasek. I'm a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, here in the middle of the roasting hot desert, joined, as always, by the story specialist, the Baroness Libby Young. I cannot do an accent, and I will not be trying. But if we, you know, just imagine that Brad said it. And as every week, we have Dave.
Dave.
Libby, do you know where Santa is?
I do. So it's a tough time to be an ecologist because, well, the world's burning and melting and suffocating in human trash. So Sam was actually inspired by this week's movie and just decided to take some time to pursue a backup career. As a private investigator / bounty hunter. He's told me that he's actually now swamped with cases, including a dingo that has been unfairly profiled by a mother claiming it ate her baby.
Okay.
He has a case of a disappearing shrimp from a Barbie. And then there's an elusive flasher that whips out his penis and yells, "That's not a knife, this is a knife." And then a kangaroo that is capturing and using humans as personal transportation to and from its university classes. Sam says that he wants me to tell the listeners that if you do have a case that pops up, then please call 555-CRIKEY or email him at therescuerdownunder@drongo.com or snail mail at psherman42 Wallaby Way, Sydney.
And so I've walked outside and I said, "Oh, what are you doing, mate? Like, you can't be leaving the scene." And he goes, "Don't be a hero, mate." And I said, "I'm not trying to be a hero, but the police are coming."
Anybody got news this week?
I have news. First of all, happy Juneteenth, which I don't know if it'll be Juneteenth, when this airs, but it's Juneteenth now, motherfuckers. So my news this week is also U.S. related. The U.S. House passed a bill this week to conserve endangered species in a 231-190 vote this past Tuesday.
Wow, hey.
Which means there's 190 dickheads that don't give a fuck about the planet in the House. But the Recovering America's Wildlife Act would create an annual fund of more than $1.3 billion given to states, territories, and indigenous nations for wildlife conservation on the ground. And while threatened species, you might think like, hey, wait a minute, we have like Endangered Species Acts. But they've been defined and protected under the Endangered Species Act since 1973. That law does not provide adequate funding at all to proactively maintain their numbers. So this is like a really big deal to actually put some money where people's mouths are.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Those organizations are always in desperate need of more funding. And while this might not be enough to solve the problem, it will definitely go a long way to helping these places out.
It'll help some creatures for sure.
Continuing that positive news, California in May set a new record by running 100% on renewable energy. Basically, on May 8th, the state was able to produce enough renewable energy to meet 103% of their consumer demand. Now, this isn't to say
that's awesome
that they're completely off the non-renewable sources yet, because there's still some variation with their wind and solar production. But the state has basically said, I mean, if they were a separate country on their own, they would be the fifth highest economy in the world. And they're basically saying, hey, guys, if you use a lot of the similar things that we do, you know, they do get more sun and wind. But they're saying that this is a model that could be spread to other areas of the world.
That's really cool. And it's nice to hear about someplace in the U.S. doing that, because I feel like whenever we hear those anecdotes about a country running on, you know, 100% renewable, 70% renewable. It's always Germany or maybe Sweden.
It's never the U.S. So,
no, exactly. Sure, it's California, you know, all those liberal people down in Los Angeles, you know, doing the good work of climate change and renewable energy. Los Angeles. Hopefully this is good news for the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm. So my last bit of news was about Paleospondylus gunai, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but Sam's not here to correct me, so fuck it.
Perfect.
Yeah, do either of you know what a paleospondylus is?
I nope. can't say that I do.
I didn't. it is a toothless eel-like critter discovered in a Scotland quarry in 1890. So for the last 132 years, it has defied classification and sat very enigmatically on the evolutionary tree. But this year, thanks to micro CT scans and advanced synchrotron machines, basically advanced imaging, researchers have a lead for the first time since its discovery. So this is a quote from Tatsuya Hirasawa, which is the lead researcher. He said, "Our analysis provided an inference that the Paleospondylus was a close kin to vertebrates having limbs with fingers and those having limb-like fingers. So this suggests that the species was an aquatic predecessor of our very first marine mammals, animals to crawl to shore. So aka possibly one of our earliest ancestors."
It is really cool.
That's really neat.
Yeah. It's really cool what the modern, like this thing has been around for 130 years. Like it's not like a new discovery, but we just haven't been able to do anything with it because of technology.
Hmm.
Now we can.
Yeah. Technology backlogs. We talked a lot about this on our episode for the Relic, or Sam did specifically, the value of museum collections.
Yeah.
And just all that data that sits behind a wall somewhere waiting for a researcher to dedicate their master's, their PhD, their entire academic career to sorting through it and writing some papers.
Yeah.
So I'm really glad they're able to do this.
I think about it, like, how often have I put off, like, a household chore that I know I needed to do and I don't get to it till like 2 years, you know, like that thing sits on your dresser for 2 years waiting to be fixed, but imagine that in the world of science.
Science rules.
So this week we did critters. A highly intelligent and ravenous dust bunnies escape an asteroid prison and set course on a stolen ship for Earth, of course. These escaped prisoners unfortunately don't make friends with a sweet but socially outcast Hawaiian girl, but instead land in Kansas on the Browns family farm. Because I too would go fucking berserk on a farm in the middle of nowhere, Kansas. These hoggishly heinous hairballs begin terrorizing and trying to eat the Midwesterners. Meanwhile, Pleakley and Jumba, the space bounty hunters, searching to destroy the critters, execute pretty terrible bounty hunting skills and blast their way through the town, destroying any lead they might encounter. Luckily for the bounty hunters and the family, the youngest son, whose name is Brad Brown, but we're going to call him Bread Brown because Bread is the name that his dad calls him in the entire movie.
Yep.
So, luckily for the family, the youngest son, Brad Brown, saves his family's life multiple times, including going back for the cat, mark of a real hero. Rescues his sister from inside the fucking spaceship as it's about to take off, and does the fairly useless bounty hunter's job by destroying the krites as they try to flee from his badassery. Unfortunately for Steve, his dead body is left in the barn, only later to become a phantom. Which, that's a phantom pun, if, nice. If any of you are familiar with
Billy Zane. Yep.
I think we're all very familiar with Billy Zane and his many iconic works.
The phantom is real.
So what do we think about this movie? What do we like, rather?
I was so surprised by this movie. I only found... So I was the one who suggested this movie for the podcast, and I only found it from doing, like, searching just for movies for episodes. I don't claim to know all movies, but I do know a lot, and somehow this one has just consistently slipped under my radar. It's, like, a beautiful mix of so bad it's good and actually good. Like, the moment I start to laugh at it for being hilariously bad is the exact moment they do something that's actually really great. So I just enjoyed watching it, and the krites are really cute.
The krites were super cute. Much like Libby, I feel like I have a pretty extensive knowledge of movies, especially 80s monster movies that are made with, you know, fun practical effects or maybe cult classics. And I had heard of this, but I keep I think that I might actually be conflating that with memories of the Langoliers, which is another small, or at least ball-shaped organism that eats a lot of stuff, including reality, I think. But we'll cover that on another episode sometime down the line. This movie was a fucking riot. I really, really enjoyed it. Bread was the hero we all needed. I can never remember his last name, sorry. Terrence Mann as this just straight man, alien bounty hunter walking around town fucking shit up, and his buddy, you know, whichever actor was playing the shape-shifting buddy at the time, just scaring the fuck out of the sheriff of the town, and him just staring at them in abject terror the entire time was so delightful.
The sweetest space dusters you'll ever see. Yeah. Those jackets were badass.
They were badass.
God, looking cool in red leather way before the Ravagers ever tried.
Exactly.
I loved the family. This was actually a family that I was like, I thoroughly enjoyed. I liked the dynamics between the mom and the dad, that the dad is not being the typical like overbearing farm dad, won't allow like the boy into his house. The mom is still being realistic when, you know, he's like, did you have the talk with her? And she's like, years ago. I enjoyed that Billy Zane's character was not the typical like rich kid who shows up in his car who's mean to the dad. Like, he's polite when he gets there. He brings her books. And even when she's trying to get things started in the farmhouse, he's just like, hey, I'm really worried your dad is going to kill me. We are like 10 feet away from the house. I am uncomfortable with this situation.
Yeah, she initiates everything.
Yeah. And I felt like they were a good family. Even when the dad's down in the basement getting attacked by the creatures and like his son tries to run down, his first instinct is like, no, don't come down here. Like they seemed like good people. I will also say I adored the space bounty hunters as well. And I too feel the desire that if I was going to a alien planet, I would want to model myself after a famous rock star if I could choose to be anyone. And I even like the way that he kind of like looks over at his compatriot when he's choosing the rock star face, and he's like, fuck it, I'm doing this anyway.
Don't you say a goddamn word.
Exactly. You're Johnny Steele.
Right. Like, that's the thing. You are supposed to camouflage yourself to blend in. The other alien, at least, is trying to take on different faces terribly and at completely inopportune times.
And in front of everybody.
Exactly. To try and blend in, which he's doing a shit job, but at least he's doing it a little bit better. As opposed to the rock star one who's clearly like, I love this face. I love this hair. And everyone's just like, why are you here?
Doesn't say a word, just shoots his gun and walks away.
Love it.
What did we not like about this movie?
So, I'm going to slightly disagree with Dave. I did not like the mom. I did like her in the beginning, and then I feel like pretty quickly she turned sour for me. It's less to do with her character and mostly to do with her acting. I felt like everyone's acting was really good, except hers. That's and fair. It just really highlighted how bad she was for me.
Yeah, I think I'm about to piggyback off of that and say that was my only real downside for this movie. I would have said the cat getting killed, but Chewie did not get killed, so
Chewie
is A for me for that. Oh, Chewie. But I also started out liking her quite a bit. It was a really good family dynamic, and for the rest of the movie, the whole family was good, except for her, and that's mainly due to the acting, I would say, as well.
I would say my only disagreement, or sorry, my only negative against the movie was I never felt the family was in the level of peril we've gotten in some of these other horror movies where it feels like the monsters are capable. I mean, don't get me wrong, I loved how incapable our critters were in this, but they're built up as like this spacefaring species with language and advanced technology. I mean, they fly a fucking spaceship to Earth and then they get there and they are struggling to chew through a couch or getting distracted with an E.T. toy. Yeah, right? I mean, it leads to fantastic scenes. The humans have guns, followed by one of them shotgunning the other one in the face that blows it up, and then the one next to him going, fuck, before he runs down the stairs. Was to die for. But I never felt the same level of like horror that we sometimes get out of these films. Maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I'm not afraid. Yeah. So moving on to Trivium, I'll kick us off with a little bit of, speaking of the critters themselves, Corey Burton, who is the one who voices the critters, they also came up with their language, which he describes in interviews as combining elements of French and Japanese. I don't hear either one of those languages in the critters, but maybe it's just so well blended you don't notice.
Take his word for it.
I adore all of the the little nods that this movie has to other horror movies in the same genre. The creature coming up from the toilet referenced is basically a hint from Ghoulies. Obviously, we do have the E.T. toy of who are you before the critter starts chewing on its head. And even the bowling jackets were purposely made up to look like a send-off of Ghostbusters, which is just so good.
And the cat's name, Chewie, after Star Wars. There are several Star Wars references in it, from my understanding as well.
Totally missed that.
And the color palette of their bowling shirts are actually a direct reference to Egon's uniform from the Ghostbusters TV series.
There are nerds who worked on this movie who I adore. They are good humans.
I know Adam made a joke about it earlier, so although widely believed to have been inspired by Gremlins and the success of Gremlins, the director has refuted this in interviews, pointing out that the script was written long before Gremlins went into production, subsequently underwent rewrites to reduce the apparent similarities between the two films.
I mean, yeah, there's definitely similarities, but they feel like very distinct and different monsters and very distinct and different movies.
Yeah, they don't, other than they're small, like I honestly don't really see too many similarities.
My last bit of trivium is, so we mentioned him earlier, Terrence Mann, the actor who plays Johnny Steele, a.k.a. I think Ugg is his bounty hunter name, or is he Lee?
So they're not credited with either in this movie. That only happens in Critters 2. They don't have names in this movie.
Well, the Johnny Steele bounty hunter, he actually performed the Power of the Night, Terrence Mann did. And if you're like me, you might not recognize young Terrence Mann, but he plays Whispers in the show Sense8, a very detestable and very intimidating villain. So it was really fun seeing him play this.
Holy crap! Cool!
That's him!
We both know exactly what's going to happen. One by one, I'm going to hunt your cluster down.
All right, now before we get into the science, you can find, if you want to get in contact with us, suggest movie monsters, give us some feedback, tell us you like us, tell Dave how pretty he is. He always appreciates that.
I do.
You can write us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can check out our website at cinematicaanimalia.com. If you want to see some of the writing that Libby does, I don't have a good adverb, adjective, adjective, noun combination like Sam does. So I'm just going to say a crikey Australian of literary content. You can check out Short Story Soup at .substack.com. You can follow Sam on Twitter at Big Dr. Fishboy. You can follow me on Twitter at Hassock Adam. And if you want to see any more of the more hardcore science that Sam, myself, and a very broad array of international writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And if you want to get into some gaming with Dave, the Baroness, or myself, check us out on Discord. The link will be in the episode description.
Do it.
Do it.
So, for these critters, I know Dave has I'm very excited at least to hear his segment on how they kind of get around with their rolling motion, but I want to kind of pose a brief evolutionary history for these creatures first. Mm. So, the Crichton, Crites?
Crites.
Crites.
Where are the Crites?
The Crites, aka the critters, are very small. Most of them are less than a foot tall, less than 30 centimeters. They have very short, stubby limbs. Their whole face is just a mouth, basically, and these glowing red eyes. Now, my first thought when I saw creatures that were built like this, at least for the mouth structure, is deep-sea predators. Yeah. Like the hag, not the hagfish, like the anglerfish, the goblin shark is a similar type of structure, but basically something that is all mouth, all stomach, nothing else really. Because they live in environments that don't have much available resources or food for them to eat or grow. So whenever they find something, they need to be able to eat all of it pretty quickly and without leaving anything to waste. And this is why you can see pictures.
I thought you were describing yourself, all mouth and all stomach.
Well, that goes without saying. I will be eating many burgers and fries later tonight. But predators that live in environments like that need to be able to eat everything they find. And this usually can result in those very fun pictures that you see of a, quote, small predator eating something that is two, maybe even three times its size, and it's just enormously distended stomach. Now, I think that because of their voracious eating habits and the supposed size change we see later on in the movie, I think that's what is actually going to be happening with these critters, where they eat everything they can. They're not from this planet. They can maybe tell that the leather couch used to be a cow, so there might be some kind of cue there for what might have been a prey animal at one time. They eat the cow in the field, so maybe they recognize the smell. And they just eat everything. Leather E.T. toy, the chickens, thankfully not Chewie. parts of the poor cop who's just wants donuts and coffee after his long night shift.
Pieces of cars.
Pieces of cars. And we see them get bigger through the movie.
Firecrackers.
Yeah, firecrackers. Cherry bomb. It was a great scene. But the one at the very end appears to be the size of a person, if not larger. And I think what this actually is people surviving a very traumatic event and kind of misremembering what things were really like. So,
see, I thought it was just a man in a suit.
It was definitely a man in a suit, but the man in the suit would not be growing as quickly as the critter did. And I think what actually happened is these people just remembered a very fat, unable to move critter that had eaten way too many chickens, way too much of the pork chop, and way too much of the cow, and just appeared larger.
Yeah, that would be an expandable stomach.
Mm-hmm. We also see that this critter is seemingly working together to take down most of the organisms they come in contact with. Not all of them, and it's not quite a true pack structure like you would see with the African wild dog or a wolf or orcas, for example. But they are a reasonably intelligent species. They do understand there is power in numbers. You know, there are 8 of them.
And space travel.
It's not quite the power of the night. And space travel.
Their teamwork is kind of shit. The one who gets set on fire, nobody else tries to put him out. He has to run towards the toilet himself, and then they just leave him in there.
Yep.
I'm just going to maintain, they're like humans. They didn't build the spaceship. They took that spaceship. And maybe they just kind of got lucky taking it from that prison they were on, from the weird Twi'lek-looking dude in the hover chair. But
that looks like Rigel to me.
So they're intelligent enough to use a spacecraft. They somewhat work together to kind of tag team the bigger people they're trying to take down. I'm assuming that it wasn't just one of them eating that cow. And they usually attack in groups for the humans. Now, I think this is going to be the product of some kind of evolutionary history whereby they have adapted to eat or go after larger organisms. Maybe they move around in packs and they happen to find either a large prey animal or a large carcass they can try to get a hold of. And they just eat until they apparently grow and then go on about their merry way later on. Because they have no fear and no problem taking on something that is 10, 20 times their size, who knows how many times their mass. Which is kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And going hand in hand with that is their apparently paralytic spines they're able to shoot out of the top of their head.
Yeah.
Now, while this is a pretty stylish mohawk, and I am pretty jealous of it, younger Adam would have killed to have a spike mohawk like that I could move around and shoot at people especially. The kind of hit-or-miss nature of the venom they appear to be injecting into both the dad and the daughter would be handy for taking down a larger prey that was alive. Because, as we see, these things don't stand a chance when somebody isn't afraid of them and can, you know, take the second to boot them across the room. To me, I think all of those factors kind of add up to a small prey animal that has adapted to eat a lot of food because it lives in a very resource-poor environment.
I have a question. And this is kind of a dumb question,
yes,
but I'm allowed to ask dumb questions. What is the purpose of having several rows of teeth like that?
I have an idea. Dave, do you have an expert knowledge on this, or do you want me to take it?
Yeah, generally speaking, I mean, the species we see it in are replaceable teeth, right? We're talking about the rows associated with sharks. They're not chewing or cutting. It's just they're having new ones that are coming into place. But usually it's their teeth are folded in. They're not in the active motion of chewing, pulling, crunching.
Mm-hmm, that makes sense.
Yeah. That's kind of my thought. An adaptation to losing teeth from an organism that has nothing but a mouth, basically, to manipulate objects and try to defend itself, eat, potentially know what something is. Dogs don't have hands. These things do, but maybe not that great. So dogs use their mouth for everything. And you're breaking teeth, you're going to need to grow them back.
Mouth is really important for screaming a obscenity when your friend gets shotgun blasted next to you.
Nope.
I fucking would, shit.
The dude who gets shotgun blasted through the door by the mom fucking killed me too. That they hit him and the other two are just like, well, fuck you, and take off down the stairs.
I actually really enjoyed her line. She was like, I got one. Like, she was so excited.
Got you. Another feature that we just kind of wanted to talk about in this that I found the most interesting was how these creatures get around. So anytime it seems that they need to move at speed, they immediately ball themselves up and then take off, basically, after whatever it is they are going after.
Or use a spaceship.
Or use a spaceship badly.
Hyperdrive,
they just land on Earth and they're like, what do we do now? And then they're like, food. But they do have lasers. They have the capability of raising the ship up and blasting things. I don't know why they wouldn't just blast their way through a farmyard and then land again and start
and
eating everything.
A house out of nothing more than spite.
Yeah, they're dicks. It's a good system. Now, in terms of species that roll, we have a couple of different examples, and I'm going to add caveats onto this, of species.
Is it me
that,
after I eat a pizza? I just roll myself?
Just rolling back and forth?
It is. I can confirm.
So the top group of species that roll are those that roll to escape predators. And the best examples, the ones that I love the most, are tiger beetle larvae and the Mount Lyell salamanders. Now, I don't know if you guys have seen videos of either of these.
I have.
I'm not of the salamanders. I didn't know that. That's really cool.
They're really cool, and they are fast, as Adam would love to say.
Fast as fuck, boy!
Fast as fuck, boy!
There we go. So, in terms of these two species, so this is a system that's designed to basically move away when threatened. So, for tiger beetle larvae, there are beaches that are basically home to these little creatures, and the beetles themselves are actually known as some of the fastest insect runners, but their larvae are slow. They're worm-like. So when they're exposed or threatened, running isn't an option. Instead, they turn themselves into these living wheels. They basically bundle themselves up. They leap into the air and coil their bodies into a loop. The winds that run along those beaches catch them and move them super quick. It's really fun to watch these guys. They get threatened. They literally hop up. They grab their tail. The wind catches them and they are just gone. Now, the other...
That's really
it's
fun.
Super cool. Now, the Mount Lyell salamanders, on the steep slopes of California's Sierra Nevada mountain range, these salamanders basically live up there. And the writer that I found who'd summarized them referred to them living a rock and roll lifestyle. It's pretty good.
I like it.
God.
So when disturbed, threatened, and they need to basically descend, they curl themselves, placing their head under their back legs, wrap the tail on their body, tuck it in. They look like a tire and then basically bounce down the mountain at top speeds. Their bodies are specifically designed to absorb the impact. And it's actually a really cool area of biomechanic interest that we study this to figure out. Like, you need to absorb a lot of force when you're bouncing down the mountain.
Yeah, especially in rocky terrain. I would be worried about punctures.
It takes a lot out of
you. Yeah, they're cool. Now, you'll notice that both of these examples of species are creatures that roll using other forces. They're not using their own physical energy to get themselves to move, right? They're rolling downhill or they're rolling associated with the wind. There are other organisms that ball themselves up, usually to avoid predators. So pangolins are a good example. Or hedgehogs. They basically, though.
Or pill bugs.
Now, in terms of the mechanics and the physics that go along behind this, I found a really good piece that was basically summarizing the difference associated with human locomotion and rolling, because the big question is, we know that rolling is a way more effective way to move around. You can bicycle way further and way faster than you can run, and we also know that, generally speaking, it's a more effective way to travel, right? When we get cars, roads, the wheel is a much better way, and from a physics perspective, yeah, it makes way more sense. So the question is, why haven't more organisms evolved to roll and basically use that as their primary locomotion when they're actually under their own level of control? And the biggest reason is the same one as anyone who's ever tried to build a Mars rover has run into. It's fucking hard to try and like set up the mechanics. There's a whole reason we have to flatten huge areas of our planet to make them perfectly still and then cover them in asphalt for us to roll along them.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, moving along terrain, although it is more wasteful associated with energy to change your center of gravity to lift up a leg and then place it back down, it allows you to go up hills, which is anyone who's ever tried to bike up a hill will know that that's a pain in the ass. It's easier to do it when walking than it is to do with wheels. And even on flat areas like the plains, they're never perfectly flat. There's going to be holes, there's going to be bumps, there's going to be other things to run into. Now, that being said,
especially if you're in Mississippi,
there is one species that I feel that Adam will connect to as well, that does take on rolling as its natural form of locomotion to basically move across big areas of the plains. And they are heavily featured in Westerns. The good old tumbleweed. is actually one of our best examples of
rolling on high.
Above ground portions of the plants, separate from the root structure, roll in the wind to distribute their seeds. They're found in open plain environments. It's a really good way of getting around. They literally, now they're still being carried by the wind. They're not actually creating locomotion to do this, but they're taking advantage of the setup of the planes to actually move across it.
It's a fantastic strategy.
But generally speaking, the action of trying to roll on any other terrain is just not going to work. I have no idea how these creatures would be bringing about that rolling motion that we see in the movies. And it's fantastic. It's fun. It's cool. But there's a reason why nothing on Earth has evolved to roll under its own power. It's just, generally speaking, not an effective strategy and not one that you can use under a variety of different surfaces. If you come to a planet that's covered in pavement and asphalt, yes, maybe you would evolve to roll everywhere.
I like to think that when they're in their roll, they time it really well and just kind of give a little, like, a little boost with their tiny crunch hands as they're going along. Yeah, super crunch, kind of...
See, I like to think that on the backs, it's not just spines, it's actually tiny little millipede legs. And so they're not rolling, they're actually just walking.
The action that they are taking of rolling down the stairs and rolling down other elevated surfaces, because it might just be that they're seen to roll down those a couple of times and the humans misrepresent, would fit with Adam's theory of a species that lives in something like a mountain range with limited food.
Speaking of resource-poor environments, Dave, in your research on rolling, did you find anything about the golden wheel spider?
I did, but I didn't end up reading about it. Feel free to educate.
This goes really well with your theory, or your evidence, rather, on getting away from a predator, or in this case, a parasitoid. So the golden wheel spider lives in, or it's a group of spiders, the wheel spiders, that live in the Namib Desert in southern Africa. Very resource-poor environment, very hot, a lot of hills. And this spider tends to, you know, perch itself up on top of a hill, trying to get out of the sun, look for some prey. But occasionally, along comes a parasitoid wasp. Now, if you're familiar with tarantula hawks, these are gigantic wasps that will look for a very large spider, like a tarantula, to paralyze, drag back to their prey, to their den, lay an egg on, and let their baby eat the thing alive because the spider can't move anymore. So these parasitoid wasps will be looking for these spiders. These spiders will see these wasps coming or detect them somehow and be like, nope, and basically start running down the slopes, which is adorable to see a spider run. But then they kind of either jump or fall and just start rolling like a motherfucker, and they just yeet themselves down these sand dunes. Do yourself a favor, look up golden wheel spider rolling. It is adorable and really fun. They see me rolling,
they hate it. I did want to clarify, why do you guys have a theory as why the toxins or paralytics are more potent seemingly in the women than the men in this movie?
Well, men are tough.
Because farmers more buff. Yeah.
the critters are sexist.
I think it had to do with the location of where the spine strikes.
Okay.
With the strike, I would suspect that the paralytics that they're carrying, which, I mean, we've talked about before, you can't shoot spikes off yourself. It doesn't make sense from a perspective of, it's just so wasteful. You want to actually stick it into someone, like the porcupine.
Hey.
But depending on where these quills get stuck, if it's just into, say, the intramuscular or subcutaneous tissue versus it actually gets stuck into a blood vessel and works systemically,
okay.
If it's going to have systemic effects, it's probably what knocked out the mum, as opposed to the other people who we see who have much more minor effects. I'm imagining it gets lodged in the muscular or subcutaneous tissue. That makes
sense. It could also be a matter of body mass. The old Bread Senior is a bit larger than his wife and daughter, so
he's a big farm boy.
So I think that's pretty much wrapped up on everything we're going to talk about from the physiological standpoint. Mm-hmm. Fuck, these things were fun. Now, Libby, what are you going to take us through with your story section this week?
Well, I was very inspired by Brad, Brad Brown, because he was such a hero and kind of the only hero of the movie. I mean, there's people that do stuff, but he's like racing from one scene to take care of his family and then racing in another scene to like help the bounty hunters and then like actually fighting
the kid has no fear.
Fighting the critters and like saving his sister. Yeah, so I wanted to talk about the 9 types of heroes that we see in literature. And this is a list from a website.
9.
Yes, 9. Some of them are subtypes, but wow. I thought they were important. Yeah, this is a list from a website called Writer's Edit, too, so you feel free to look up. They have a lot more examples on there, too, to kind of help you understand. So the first one is the epic hero, and it's usually the first archetype that comes to mind when we think of heroes. They are called to adventure, they face trials, they save the day, and they will begin their story at a point of stability, and then they usually will return to that stability, except now they have been changed in some way by like their journey. So for some, this means they've gained powers, and for others, this means they like have more of a knowledge about the world at large. So these types of heroes, the example would be Odysseus or Aragorn from Lord of the Rings.
Okay. Oh.
So then the second one is the iconic hero. And this is often bundled in with the epic hero, but they aren't quite the same. Both the iconic and the epic are classically heroic. They're courageous, loyal, clever, kind of all those personality traits that you think. The difference is the epic hero goes through a journey and comes out the other end changed in some way, but the iconic hero is eternal and does not change. So an iconic hero won't die in their story. The story's other characters could change, die, or leave, but the iconic hero is sort of always what we expect them and need them to be as an audience. So these are kind of what you would think of your superheroes. So think Superman, Batman, Captain America, right? Like they go through journeys, but they're who they are at the beginning and the end of the story.
Is Gandalf an iconic hero?
He changes. Thank you very much. If you remember after his fight with the Balrog, Adam, pick up a book.
I've read a book. I mean, yeah, he changes, but I feel like his changes are within the same realm of change that Batman or Superman would go through. And
no,
to me, Gandalf is who he is the whole way through, and he is what he needs to be, right?
No, I would say Batman and Superman don't really change at all, and that Gandalf goes through a massive change. I would say he's more of an epic hero at this point.
Okay.
Libby, that's okay. Leave it to bigger Lord of the Rings fans like you and I. We'll explain this to Adam. He'll be fine.
Let me just adjust my sleeve here.
We'll just cut all of Adam's audio, just him going burp, 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 burp. So then the third type we have is the anti-hero. And we've heard this very much in popularized in media of late. So the key feature of an anti-hero is their lack of typical heroic attributes. And we've talked about anti-heroes too on this podcast before. And while a typical hero is courageous and idealistic and follows a moral code, an anti-hero does none of these things. Anti-heroes may perform actions that are morally correct according to the laws of their universe, but they don't need to perform these actions for moral reasons. Often they act for selfish reasons. So anti-heroes do what needs to be done, but they don't particularly care who they hurt along the way. So think Walter White or, my favorite, the early version of Han Solo before they completely edited his character and changed him shooting first in the Star Wars movies.
Han shot first.
He absolutely did, and they changed it because they didn't want him to be an anti-hero. They wanted him to be a different type of hero.
Boo.
Yeah. So then we have the, then we have the reluctant hero. A reluctant hero has a lot of similarities to an anti-hero. Neither of them really want to be there. They're forced to be there. However, while the anti-hero is there because of personal gain, the reluctant hero is forced to be there because to do anything else would go against their moral compass. So our perfect reluctant hero is our everyone's favorite Green Swamp Man Trek. What an all-star.
Easy.
Yeah, so he makes personal sacrifices in the movie to do what's right, even though he doesn't want to. But it's not because he's getting anything out of it selfishly. It's because he feels that moral tug, right? So, like, there's times where he saves Donkey, not because he needs to, because he doesn't really gain anything from saving Donkey. It's just like, oh, fuck. I guess I have to.
He just wanted to sit in his swamp.
Exactly.
He's like an onion.
Next, we have a liminal hero. This one's really interesting. A liminal hero is one who is in between states or spaces. They might cross over with some other types of heroes, but this type has some unique characteristics. Liminal indicates a space, a state, or a feeling that's between two established elements. So, for example, teenagers. Being a teenager is existing in a liminal state. They're not quite a child, but they're also not quite an adult yet. So because of this, a lot of YA stories feature liminal heroes. Also, a ghost is in liminal state. So they're neither dead, but they're still on this plane of existence, kind of doing this half-life thing. It's a liminal hero is a hero going through their own form of change and transition. And this affects their story, their interactions with other, and their character arc. So can you guys think of a good liminal hero that comes to mind?
Muad'Dib.
Yeah, actually, that's a good one, because my example is Spider-Man.
Yes.
And it's both of the same thing. Spider-Man is a perfect example of a liminal hero because he's facing his own sort of pubescent changes separate from his hero's journey. And Muad'Dib is the same, right? He's a kid, and then he's like journeying into adulthood at the same time as going through his hero's journey.
Cool.
Hey, kid, you're in charge of the universe now. Good luck.
Have fun. So then we have the everyman hero. They're an ordinary person with no special abilities who acts heroically. They're not Superman. They're just the person who's there. The archetype is designed to represent the average person. It can be really hard to empathize with a superpowered hero of a story, but it's really easy to connect to a regular person. So for this one, think Ellen Ripley, Frodo, Samwise Gamgee. Adam, I know you don't know who the last two of those are, but I'll tell you later.
Okay. I just know John McClane.
So then we have the romantic hero, the seventh type. And the name romantic hero doesn't refer to a hero who has romantic relationships. Instead, it refers to the romantic period of literature. The defining features of a romantic hero are their constant rejection of established norms and their sense of self-importance. They reject authority and rules and are often introverted and isolated. It's important to note while these concepts may have negative connotations, they're not necessarily flaws in the romantic hero. The heroic archetype of a misfit hero is a modern example of a romantic hero. So think Mr. Darcy from Pride and Prejudice, Katniss Everdeen from Hunger Games, and I just thought of this while I was talking, Lilo from Lilo and Stitch. She does not give a fuck about society.
Lilo cares about society. She feeds Pug the fish who controls the weather. I like weather. All right, she needs to get him peanut butter and jam sandwiches, otherwise I lose weather.
You know, I kept thinking this entire movie that Critters was the early adult version of Lilo and Stitch. Like, it really has a lot of similarities.
Yeah. Yeah, the rolling, the swearing in a language we don't understand, because you know Stitch is wandering around when he's like, goes about that.
Yeah. And the escaped convict from space, right? Like, he was in prison and he busts out and flies to Earth. Two bounty hunters on his trail.
Definitely a fuck ton of mosquitoes there.
Mm-hmm.
Now all I'm hearing is the Critter's voice of, oh god, they have human weapons. Fuck!
Fuck!
I just love the one who said, like, so? And then he gets blasted immediately.
Exactly. So next we have the Byronic hero, and that's not like a bionic hero. This is named after Lord Byron.
That wasn't just you saying ironic wrong?
No. This is named after Lord Byron, who humbly named it after himself, because he was that guy. Never satisfied with the established archetypes, he invented a twist on the romantic hero. So the Byronic hero is a subcategory of the romantic hero, but the key difference between them is while romantic heroes are better off because of their rejection of societal rules, the Byronic hero has been hurt and rejected by society. So in their isolation, they become apathetic or even dangerous to themselves and others. So good examples of the Byronic hero are Loki, BoJack Horseman, or Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights.
Okay. Interesting.
Hmm.
All right, last but least, the tragic hero.
Yes.
The tragic hero is first defined by Aristotle, and they are the central player in most tragic stories. Aristotle argued that in any good tragic story, you needed emotional investment from the audience. So we need to be sympathetic to the hero and feel catharsis at the end of their story. Which was most commonly their defeat in some way. So a tragic hero is someone who is flawed in a major way and is really doing their best, but they still meet tragedy at the end of the story, mostly due to their own flaws. they may make poor decisions or do bad things, but at their core or at their heart, they are, or at least want to be, good. And that is why their downfall is so tragic. So good examples of our tragic hero, Romeo and Juliet, more classic literature, Gatsby himself from The Great Gatsby, or Ned Stark from Game of Thrones. His flaws really led to his downfall. Mm. And you feel bad for him, but also, like, he kind of did it to himself.
One of the most frustrating things I've ever read in a book, just that entire sequence. Like, you fucking idiot. This could have...
And so that is our 9 types of heroes.
Well, Brett is obviously a tragic hero. He's obviously a Byronic hero. What would Brett be?
I think Brett is an epic hero.
He starts off heroically blowing things up with firecrackers, and he ends it going through a journey heroically blowing things up with firecrackers.
I mean, and you see that at the beginning when he's a kid, and he does the moral and right thing of trying to take the fall for the innocent baseball pitcher, ex-baseball pitcher, alien conspiracy guy, right? Like, how many kids would do that for somebody else and, like, get in trouble and miss dinner?
That kid's either going to grow up to be one of the world's greatest bomb makers or one of the world's greatest bomb diffusers. There's literally only 2 paths that exist in front of him at this point.
Yeah.
Either way, the CIA wants him. Do you two feel bad for the monsters?
I do not feel bad for the monsters. However, big caveat, I still am strangely rooting for the monsters. So if they die, like, they get in trouble, like, yeah, it's their fault. But also, like, make your escape.
Get out.
Go.
No, they were solid dicks all the way through. They kill Billy Zane right off the bat, which, dick move. He seemed like a nice kid. He wasn't trying to do anything.
It was that haircut. He needed to die. No one wears
that
mullet pony.
That was atrocious.
Ponytailed mullet.
Then bite the ponytail off.
That was really bad.
I feel like they didn't kill, they chose not to kill the cat either. They ate everything, but they left the cat alone. So, I mean, they're A-okay in my book.
Mm. And then the final move, as Libby pointed out, of they fly the spaceship just over top of the house, and they're just like, fuck you, and blow it up. That felt like a dick move.
Yeah, I'm with Libby. I respect them and their moxie. It's not good what they're doing, but I'm still rooting for them.
Strangely rooting for them.
Exactly. Segueing off of that, I would 100% recommend this movie. It is such a fun time.
This was so good. This was way better than I thought it was going to be going into this.
Yeah, I definitely would recommend this. I think that if you, for some reason, dislike 80s creature features, then maybe not. But other than that, it's a fun time.
But also, if you could rate and review us and give us 5 stars, I would really appreciate it.
If we reach a certain amount of stars, Adam will watch Lord of the Rings for the first time.
Ooh.
I've been holding off for 20 years. You know,
I only have a tattoo of it. But I've never seen it.
Nope.
Just the one permanent mark on my body representing this fictional piece of storytelling and wonderful fantasy. So next week we're going to be taking a little bit of a segue away from movies and talk a little bit about literary worlds or non-movie worlds that we all think deserve their time on the silver screen, the golden screen, the small tiny TV screen, whichever you want to look at it. So join us for that. And remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
There's nothing cute about them. They've come a long way, and they're hungry.